Honey, I blew up the business.
Today's guest is the incredible Dirk Bischoff. This is perhaps one of my favorite episodes. So listen all the way through to the end. Dirk is a bit of a legend, actually, in social entrepreneurship. He's a serial entrepreneur in that world and is the CEO and founder of Hatch Enterprise, which, if you know of it, in London particularly, but all around the UK, is the leading light of helping underrepresented founders of startups get into the game, to learn skills, to be incubated, to be accelerated, to realize their visions and do good in the world, to have purpose as well as profit. They started in South London, but are now UK-wide, and they have a fund where they invest in startups. He's 10 years old this year, helped 8,000 businesses, and they've got a plan to do like a lot more than that in the future. He's got a very ambitious plan. He was awarded the London Leader in 2013 by the Mayor of London and was a top 100 influential by the Sunday Times for his work with entrepreneurs in London. A fascinating character. He originated from East Germany and lived through the time where East Germany became Germany and went from a socialist or communist system to a capitalist system within a few years. And so then he left East Germany to go to the beating heart of capitalism, London town. And we get into what drove that. And what the reason why I think is one of the most interesting podcasts I've had is through the conversation, we get to something which he's never spoken about before, and perhaps even on a podcast. And this is really deep work. And he did the great gift of being super open about this, something very, very personal within his family dynamics, his relationship with his father, and how that influenced him and impacted him. And this is what I would call part of the sort of dark side of entrepreneurship, the shadow side. And we get into all of that, the shadow, the concept of the shadow, the things that are beneath the surface that are driving you. Dirk's a big fan of the psychiatrist Carl Jung and his thinking. And that's why we connected, actually. It's through a post that he'd made on LinkedIn about Carl Jung. The episode is full of fantastic insights, of change, of uncertainty, of exploring new territory, new ground. And the role of mentors, the importance of knowing what you don't want to do, and this great quote he talks about of insourcing fun into work. I love that, insourcing fun. I love to have some fun. As Joe Polish would say, you want your work to be easy, lucrative, and fun. This whole importance of his father, really a driving force for Dirk, has been trying to prove his dad wrong. And we get right into that. And there's some fantastic lessons from the first 3 years of Hatch Enterprises. It's in its 10th year now. About what he learned from what he called the experiment of the first 3 years of Hatch. He's just about to go off on a sabbatical as well. So we get into the whole topic of taking time to recuperate and get perspective on your job as an entrepreneur. And that's a really fantastic thing I want to try and do, actually. And I think we can all learn from taking some perspective, taking some time. If you don't know who I am, I'm Dan Kirby. I'm the podcast host of Honey, I Blew Up the Business. I'm the host of this podcast because guess what? In 2017, I did do that. I blew up my business. I'm not really a podcaster. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm running a small business trying to do some good in the world. And okay, maybe that's like you. Maybe you're trying to do that. And so my mission is to help you learn from the mistakes I made in the run-up to blowing up my business and subsequently. We've turned it around now. My business didn't go bankrupt. It was on the verge of it. But we turned it around. It's better than ever now, 5 years later. Who knew? A lot of the lessons from the blow-up has helped me to do that. So my mission is to help you avoid some of those mistakes and talk to people like Dirk, some of the world's leading entrepreneurs, about what they've learned, what it's really like. None of this Hallmark card, fluffy, motivational sort of quote stuff. This is the real talk, often getting into the dark side of entrepreneurship. This is what you really need to know, because it's tough being an entrepreneur. It can sometimes be lonely. You can sometimes feel isolated. I know I do quite often, still today. I'm still living this life. So if you want to join the growing community, you can help out. And the way you can help out is by sharing it with your mates, sharing it with all the people you know who run a startup or run a business, and giving us a review on all your favorite platforms like Spotify or Apple. Do a good thing, because that really helps us to reach more people. And there's a growing community around the podcast, and that's something I want to nurture. And you can really help. We're the same tribe. We want to be helping each other together. And I did mention my business in passing. The tech department is my business, and it graciously supports this podcast. Thanks, guys. We are doing great, and they're a great team. I'm really honored to be able to sort of continue my entrepreneurial journey with the tech department. 19 years old this year we are. Give us a high five virtually through the air. And without any further ado, I'll bring you Dirk Bischoff. Right, let's get into it because I'm excited and it's Monday and I'm now all psyched up, done my shouting. Okay, we're ready in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the podcast. We've got Dirk Bischoff here today. Nice to see you, Dirk.
Nice to meet you again.
Yeah, I'm super excited because this is a conversation that sparked out of a chat on LinkedIn under a blog post that Dirk had written, which I'm going to get into about his first mentor, the psychiatrist Carl Jung. But I want to get into, so I'm going to go way back to kick off here because we like to go back to people, start off people's stories. And in fact, this podcast perhaps could be renamed Honey, I Blew Up the Soviet Union, because your entrepreneurial journey seemed to start around about that time. So I think you were just about to hit your teens and you lived through one of the biggest shifts in 20th century history. So what was happening for you around that time?
Yeah, so growing up in East Germany, just before the wall came down, I think I had like 9 or 10 years before the wall came down. And then in 98, 90, you know, the German Democratic Republic crumbled as it did already for so many years before actually falling apart. And the Berlin Wall came down. And, you know, some people always think like, you know, it was just a wall around Berlin. No, the Berlin Wall extended all across kind of Germany, north to south. And overnight we went from being a socialist country to being one where capitalism is ruling. And there was a really big, big shift for so many people, so many communities, so many businesses that went, you know, from being state owned with being told what to produce and how much to produce to no longer being sure what to produce, if anything at all. So many of them were asset stripped, sold off, bankrupted. Some smaller businesses were thriving, restarting, and some people, you know, started their own businesses. And that's what my dad did from his failing state employer. You know, I think he bought machinery, plots of land and kind of halls where all these machines were standing for like one Deutschmark back in the days, because it was all going to go down the drain. And yeah, that was, I think, 1992 when he started his first business and when I started seeing him getting lots of gray hair.
Yeah, indeed. I know that's why I've got a shaved head now, because mine's all gray. So that was 1992 and you were in your early teens.
Yeah.
So you kind of, I mean, again, it's funny, we're living through lots of big shifts now, right, in history. But that, for those that weren't there, and I was a bit older than you at the time. Hmm. Even then, I was just like a teenager sort of going, yeah, there's some stuff going on. You don't really realize how much a big thing that was. And for someone to live through a complete switch and shift in a 3-year period from, like you say, a socialist country to a capitalist country, and then almost be sort of in the slipstream of your dad's innovative urge or the entrepreneurial urge, you're going to see this transition into this new world. I mean, I know it's a long time ago and you were quite young, but could you remember what that felt like? Did you have any emotions around that time that you recall?
I mean, I think the prevalent kind of feeling from from just before the wall came down was one where everything was provided for. Like if you were a child or a young person, you could never be bored. You know, schools were offering so many after school clubs from, you know, like nature and hiking to, you know, technology and, you know, the early versions of computers to whatever you could possibly want to. You were not bored. And then around holidays, even though you couldn't go very far because you could only go to, you know, Eastern European countries or south, you know, to Hungary, everything else was pretty much locked. People still had a good time because you didn't have a lot, but you shared a lot and the sense of community, because everybody, you know, some people had access to like, some people had access to, you know, bricks and mortar, and people were trading and bartering. And that really built a sense of community where I still remember all our barbecues where, you know, always full of people, 20, 30 people came, you know, we had a great time. And then when the wall came down, there was a real sense of a lack of that security. You know, there was, you know, the GDR had full employment. There wasn't literally like no unemployment. If you wanted a job, there was a job for you, even though it might have been quite menial, etc. But there were jobs, there was security. The basic provisions were all catered for. You couldn't buy any luxury items. Like you had to wait like 15 years for a car. So, you know, when children were born, you know, that's the time when you start registering that they might have a car at some point, 15, 16 years later.
Yeah.
But from a real strong sense of security to a lot of nothing and make your own and do your own. That was a big shift that a lot of people just didn't really survive, and they, you know, became unemployed and never found employment again, like so many during that time. So it was a real mental shift, emotional shift, political, economic, in so many ways. And yeah, just some people were left behind and they never got back up again. And then some people used the opportunity and, you know, build things.
Mm. And do you think, you know, again, I know it's a long time now and you were very young, but do you think you're such a, it feels to me like it's a quite a formative experience. And you refer back to this thing of your dad's, the machinery shop and you having your first job there and cleaning the machinery. What did you think you learned from that? And we'll get onto your kind of career in London as a sort of hub or a center of entrepreneurship yourself. But like at that formative period, looking back, what do you think you learned from that?
I guess I learned that it takes dedication and hard work to build something from scratch. I know that my dad, you know, he often went, you know, and the company was just a short walk, maybe like six minutes walk from our house. So he went there on Saturdays, sometimes even on Sundays. He didn't have to do much. He just had to turn the machines on again or just change something. But it was a real, like, I could see the dedication. And, you know, when he also made some fun things that he would build with laser cutters or those high pressure water erosion machinery that would make super cool, intricate things. And he would make like little rabbits that he then, you know, gave away to his clients. So sometimes he just made fun things, but he'd often combine, like, you know, he really loved what he did. Like it was his passion and he really delivered. He always wanted to deliver something of quality. And up until the day he sold his business, he never had a website. I think, I'm not even sure if he was listed in the yellow pages. I don't think so. But he was like, the quality of our work has to be our calling card. The quality of our work is the one thing that will bring customers back again and again and again. And that kind of focus on quality was something that I feel like I understood and got from that really early period, even though I was only there to, you know, scrap machinery. At some point, I learned how to like program some of them. Yeah. Metal engineering wasn't my bag, even though I tried really hard for like 3.5 years. But yeah, I ran away as far as I could from metal engineering to do something else. But I remember like focus on quality, focus on customer support. He loved going and visiting his customers and helping them solve problems. That was his thing. He was always in the car driving around and yeah, building good relationships with his customers.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. These are sort of principles that maybe sound obvious, but I think can get easily lost by people. You know, that the fact that a quality product is ultimately what people are buying from you. And if you're trying to last for a long time and not just, you know, pump it and dump it or what have you,
yeah,
that's really important. And it sounds like your dad had a sense of humor too, or a sense of fun.
Yeah, like he built like those little metal things that, looking at it from one side, it's a rabbit. And then when you turn it around, it became, what was it? A rabbit and a pig. Yeah, a rabbit and a pig.
Wow.
And, you know, it was the same piece of metal but he engineered it to be cut out in a certain way where just, you know, the mirror image was just another animal. And yeah, he made loads of like weird things with, you know, his laser cutting machines, from, you know, Christmas decorations to like all kinds of stuff.
Wow. But, I mean, what's interesting about that story is it's such a kind of vivid picture for me of this switcheroo that happened in this very short period of time, which almost is perhaps incomprehensible for us in the UK now. I mean, maybe we'll see something like that, but even our big dramas now don't really relate to that in terms of day-to-day experience of life. You know, you might be fearful about
stuff. Changed overnight.
Yeah, like the switcheroo. And then your dad in this sort of the rubble of the Soviet, of the wall, the rubble of the war. took this kind of initiative to build a business and to sort of build on his passion and skills and innate perhaps principles or his intuition. And what's interesting, those all those factors there are kind of a kind of interesting principles. And that perhaps whilst you said you escaped, obviously it's been an imprint on you at that perhaps that formative period. So you say you escaped. So what? So how did you escape from the metal engineering world? Where did you go?
So because his like my dad's thought was that at some point I will take over his metal engineering business. So I became a metal engineer. But instead of doing it in his company or in a company close by, you know, I went much further away where I had to kind of get accommodation. So I essentially moved out of my family home at age 16, did a 3.5 year metal engineering apprenticeship in some village in Saxony. And I really kind of loathed pretty much every single minute of those 3.5 years. I just couldn't go with the program, being in a small village, being, you know, in a job that I didn't want and I didn't like, and getting up at 5, being at work at 6. In hindsight now, I still, you know, I know what this 3.5 years did. Like I knew with a passion that I didn't want to do metal engineering. So even being very sure of what you don't want to do was a good thing. But then also obviously 3.5 years of doing something, you still pick up stuff. And, you know, one of the big things in engineering is you have to really plan your work. You have to be quite methodical. You have to really kind of follow the steps to make a certain thing. And if you don't follow the steps, you know, very often you just produce rubbish and you have to start all over again. So again, certain things were then ingrained for these 3.5 years from, again, quality focus, plan your work, be methodical, but also you should leverage those things into something that you really want to do and not something that your parents or society or whoever else might want you to do it. Mm. So, yeah. And then pretty much after metal engineering, I did my national alternative service. So I didn't want to go to the army. So I went to work in a social enterprise, as you would call it now, that was providing work for people with disabilities. And I would be roaming around cleaning phone booths for 10 months with somebody because that was their contract. And in that time, I then saw an article in the newspaper that there was an opportunity to go to England for 3 months for a fully funded European work placement, which for me, I saw as the ticket out of my hometown, the ticket out from the job I was in. I didn't really knew what I wanted to do. I just knew what I didn't want to do. And I was like, yeah, let's do this thing. I cut my national alternative service short by another 3 months because I had extended it previously. I cut it short, went onto the English language program. And then a couple of months later, I think 3 or 4 months later, I was in London.
Wow. So that all happened quite quickly.
That happened then quite quickly. Like, you know, it was decided, like, you know, I saw the article. I was like, I've got to do this thing, signed up. And, you know, 3 months later, I sat in a plane with, I think, 10 or 11 others who also wanted to escape, you know, Southeast Germany, because there wasn't a lot happening for young people at that time. And I was in my early 20s, like 21. So, you know, we were in a group of 10 or 12, and, you know, came to London. And here I did a work placement, interestingly, in a charity that was supporting homeless people with day-to-day care. You know, they had like access to nurses, supporting them with housing, supporting them with jobs. And I was the PA to the CEO. And to me, this was my second real kind of intimate understanding of that CEO and founder role, but this time not somebody who ran a metal engineering business, but somebody who ran a social business. And for me, all of a sudden, you know, the light bulb moment, I want to be a social entrepreneur. I want to do something that makes sense. I want to, you know, help some people to like realize opportunities that they might not have and create new opportunities. And I knew I wanted to be a social entrepreneur pretty much in my first 3 months of being here in the UK.
Really? What year was that?
So that would have been 2001. And in 2004, I founded or co-founded my first social business.
So you had this kind of like, so this real sequence of events that happened very quickly between you're on this kind of, you know, national service thing. You see the article, you have a switcheroo with that, and you've kind of segue a few months after that into sort of the dark beating heart of capitalism down in London. Nice.
Yeah.
And so you've gone from this period of like a decade, call it a decade of the Berlin Wall falls, you're thrust into this family business. You know what you don't want. And then you kind of see a way out kind of thing, and you zoom out and you head down and you find your calling within a few months of arriving in London.
Yeah.
And so can you get, again, like looking back at that time, can you, all that, because again, that seems that there's such a 10-year period where it's all kind of completely shifts, but these things seem to happen quite quickly within that, you know, whether that's, and looking back at it now, do you think this is just an intuition you followed rather than sort of overarching plan?
It was definitely intuition over anything else. Absolutely. Even though like there's something that was quite interesting. Like in that area where I lived, most of the young people left the area, whether they went to Berlin, whether they went abroad, whether they went to the west part of Germany, most people left. There was this real kind of get up, pack your bags, find and make your luck somewhere else. And you don't know what happens, but just go and do it. I really loved the 90s. You know, all of a sudden you had access to music, venues, parties. You know, then we had our driving license and going around to bigger cities. Then friends moved to these bigger cities. You could stay there overnight, over the weekend, etc. So it was a real fun time as well. So, you know, work was terrible, but everything outside of work was a lot of fun. And then in London, for me, you know, the idea was, what if I could insource fun into work and, you know, explore a much bigger city and see what it's got to offer? And after 3 months, I basically decided I'm going to stay. I packed my bags. I sadly, you know, told my then girlfriend, I've got to go. This place is calling me and I'm going to, you know, We knew we wouldn't survive a long-term relationship, me being abroad full-time. So we just called it a day and I moved. And that was the beginning of the end.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. I love that phrase, insourcing fun into work. That was in the forthcoming ever-promised merch stall. I'm going to make that insource fun from Dirk Bischoff on your t-shirt or poster. Boom. Yeah, indeed. Oh, and I love that intuition over anything else. So this all this whirlwind happened. Then I'm going to kind of zoom you a bit forward. I know you had a couple of other sort of social enterprises you were involved with, but to the formation of Hatch, which is where you've been leading Hatch now for a decade.
Pretty much, yeah.
And what's interesting, actually, I'm going to just before we get into that, the origin story of that, and I'm really interested in that, but you set out a 10-year plan, and I've heard you talk about this 10-year cycle of what you wanted to achieve at Hatch, and you're at that 10-year part now. But I want to zoom back in time to 10 years ago, or maybe 11 years ago, whenever it was. Can you please just explain to the audience, Hatch, can you describe what it is now, but what was in your head at the time when you set this thing up?
So what Hatch is now is one of the largest providers of enterprise support activities, programs, mentoring, coaching, cohort-based programs to underestimated, underrepresented founders across the UK. And on an annual basis, we work with about 1,000-1,500 founders through both cohort programs, workshops, masterclasses, and we recently launched our fund to support our founders with grants at this point in time so they can start and grow their businesses. But yeah, 10 years ago, this was still somewhat, or let's say 11 years ago, this was already in my mind, but not to the same scale. Like back 11 years ago, I was going through a very painful separation with my co-founder of my previous organization that had helped support lots of young adults into work placements, into finding work abroad, and also supporting entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, to figure out how they can start their business. But it was all quite niche and much smaller than what Hatch is doing right now. But it was the precursor to figuring out, here's some problems. We can turn these problems into opportunities, but we need money, we need the right people, we need the right activities to then turn these problems around or turn them into opportunities. And that's something that I think I've done for a long time, even before that, in the last kind of 20 years, turning problems or challenges into opportunities, not just for myself, but for others to then use them and build something out of them. So that was always, I think, a passion to, help solve problems, ideally at scale, and help problems through business, or help solve problems through entrepreneurship, essentially.
Mm. That's interesting, yeah. And it's that solving problems at scale is the key thing here, because it's ultimately a business should be solving a problem. That doesn't always happen to be the case when you meet people. They can't identify that. But if you can see problems, then there are opportunities. So you had this sort of instinct and ability to see that. And you had these experiences, and you were having a bit of a sore experience, this kind of divorce from the business partner at the time. And so you've got into London, and this is 2013, so about a decade on from getting into London. You've had some experiences with different businesses. You've got this painful experience with a business partner, but you've learned a whole bunch of stuff. You've had a decade's worth of lessons and explorations into the social entrepreneurship space.
Mm-hmm.
So you've perhaps feeling a bit sore. You're going into a new thing. You've got some ideas. And what was in your head? So we know where Hatch is now, but it's curious, this sort of origin story bit. You're coming out and you're like, you're on the street. The other thing perhaps has got some sore emotions around it. You're feeling perhaps naked and alone, and perhaps like, as I have felt many times, that you don't know quite what the world's going to look like in the next year or two or five. So what was Hatch in 2013 before you actually opened your doors?
So I think a few things that really contributed to it. So with my previous organization that I had co-founded, it was called Embrace. We were doing quite a number of things, and I looked after our climate change and entrepreneurship activities, where we did like European projects. I looked after our young people work placements and exchanges, and I looked after our really emerging entrepreneurship activities for younger adults. And when it was clear that me and my co-founder could no longer work together, because she wanted to go one way, I wanted to go the other way, we decided to split the organization. I would be able to take some of the projects that I had worked on and restart again, and she would keep the original organization and do the programs and projects she wanted to do. So that was really like a critical moment where I had to start up again, but I didn't start from scratch. But then pretty quickly in that time, I met somebody from an organization I'm hugely grateful for, called the Young Foundation. And they had this accelerator program for social enterprises to get them from start to scale. And I entered this with my previous organization only for them to essentially help me divorce from that organization whilst being on the program. But that accelerator program, and we are now running accelerators left, right, and center, that accelerator program gave me access to pro bono legal support, to an amazing mentor, Karen, to a financial coach, Siva, who I've just emailed a few minutes earlier. I had my peer group of other founders, and I had amazing workshop content to really figure out, like, how can you scale something that is addressing a societal or environmental program, only for me to then ask them, can I copy all your processes and your systems and set up the same thing that you're doing, but in South London? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. Don't worry. Just take our stuff and we'll be friends forever thereafter. So I had a real in-depth experience of what it would be like to be somebody that is going through these programs, knowing that we were going to be provide programs to other people afterwards. So that was a real, you call it lived experience now. And, it provided so much learning for me around how to be like, how to run a good mentoring program, how to get your founders to work with each other, what kind of content to provide in your workshops, how long these programs should be, and what other stuff you have to provide around it. So there was a real, there was like almost a mini apprenticeship yet again, like to me, I've had like three apprenticeships. One was my metal engineering. The second one was my first business that I then divorced from. And the third one was Hutch in its infancy for the first 3 years. So to me, those were my three apprenticeships that I kind of subjected myself to. And yeah, at that time, my mentor had asked me, I will only support you with one of the three things you want to do. You have to pick one. And I was like, what do you mean I have to pick one? I like environmental and climate change activities. I really liked the whole kind of work placement exchanges, and I loved entrepreneurship. She was like, you've got to focus on one. I was like, okay, let's focus on entrepreneurship. And eventually we would then cut the other two business, like programmatic activities or areas, and focused on entrepreneurship and building something really strong for founders in their early stages. And that was then really 2013, because I had already seen, if I wanted to give advice to founders, I can only do it on a one-to-one basis. This is not scalable. I have to build a team. We have to build programs that are scalable across geographies, across different types of stages that founders are at, from idea to start to grow. And I could really see this sprawling programmatic environment that we wanted to build from the onset on. But yeah, that was pretty much 10 years ago now.
And so originally you were focused around you're in South London, in Brixton, and you were sort of focused around there. But I believe you support companies across the UK now.
Yeah. So that happened really organically and really slowly. So we started in Brixton, and interestingly, one of our longest standing corporate partners, JP Morgan, leveraged a lot of their foundation funding into Loughborough Junction, which is a tiny, tiny area in South London next to Brixton. And our office was there by chance. So they leveraged the first 2 years of funding into our organization alongside the European Union for us to then help young entrepreneurs get their businesses off the ground in the local area. But very quickly, we could see that, you know, the area wasn't big enough to sustain, you know, multiple cohorts of ongoing enterprise support. And we wanted to deliver more programs across our local authority, which was Lambeth. And then we started building relationships with founders, with partners, with investors and funders to then kind of start the next bigger round of programs, which was across one local authority. We then kept going and meeting new partners, new funders who wanted us to do work in the next neighboring local authority. So bit by bit, we just slowly, organically grew from one place to another. And then after like 6-7 years, we were delivering services across all of South London. With 1 year later, somebody said like, oh, you know, we would like you to do stuff across, you know, the M25. Can you do it? We're like, yeah, we just get people to various different places and spaces and deliver the support. But it was all really quite organic, and it took us a long time to go from A to B. But I also knew that good things always take time. Like, you didn't need to rush it. And for the first 3 years, I didn't even call us a business. For the first 3 years, I called us an experiment because I knew we wanted to learn a lot, and I knew we didn't know how to do things. And there were, you know, much bigger and larger organizations who've been there, done that, who I was quite intimidated by, but I always downloaded their annual reports and looked at, you know, who's funding them, how are they doing stuff, what can I learn from them? And we insourced learning from others into our organization.
That's very smart. There you go. Great little lesson in there. Like, learn from everybody else. See, if this first 3 years was an experiment, or Hatch was an experiment for 3 years, what did you learn from that experiment?
We learned to be really close to our customers. So I knew already from my previous organization that, and from, I think, from my dad's work, that if you provide really valuable stuff to customers, they become your fans. They become people that you can trust, that you can ask questions of, that will help you build a better business over time. It's not a quick one, but if you stay close to your customers and you keep on asking, what else can we do for you? They will tell you. And if you can then provide these nuggets of help and support in a way that makes sense to them and makes sense to you, often your business will grow because you're helping solve active challenges, issues or problems. So yeah, stay close to your customers. And to me, the other big lesson was we have to build bridges. We have to build bridges between organizations and funders who have the money and want to see the impact, and for the founders that we wanted to support who didn't have any money and couldn't have bought our services at the cost that we were charging. So we had to build bridges between our corporate partners and funders and investors and our founders. And we did this through mentoring, coaching, Friendly Dragon's Den, and other opportunities to really get our corporate partners and their amazing team members to mentor or coach our founders, and vice versa. Our founders would learn from people who loved spreadsheets or who loved, you know, building marketing plans, etc. So we built this real kind of learning engine that we put everybody in, and everybody learned from one another on how to be a better entrepreneur and how to support entrepreneurs better. And that was really exciting. And that felt really alive and really valuable at the time and still now. It's still what we're doing right now.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that kind of idea of a learning engine. Checking everybody in the mix and letting them learn from each other. I think that's really interesting.
And, record the learnings, measure it, and then build reports from it. Like our impact report that we've started delivering in the first year would already demonstrate the kind of impact we were having with these early stage founders back in the days. And that impact report just kept growing over the years. And it's been one of the most important tools for us to share what we do and how we do it and why we do it. So yeah, learning, measuring, and reporting really was something that we wanted to get right. And I didn't get right with my previous organization.
That's a great little mantra. Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting. And again, what you don't do often defines what you should do. Like you say, what you don't want to do. I mean, we've all been there and cocked it up.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to just sort of do a little switcheroo now, because I do want to kind of focus on, well, you mentioned mentors and mentoring, and you're working with building bridges and collaborating, but your mentor forced this focus for you and the importance of mentors in your life. But your first mentor was Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, which when you're in those lonely nights in Southeast Germany in that small village, doing your mechanical engineering apprenticeship, you were mentored by Carl Jung. And this is how we connected through your blog post. Could you give us a little kind of flavor of who Carl Jung is and what you were being mentored about? How was he mentoring you?
I mean, Carl Gustav Jung is one of the leading psychologists, psychiatrists in his field. You know, he developed theories around the collective unconscious and the personal unconscious. When you hear people talk about the shadow or the Myers-Briggs that goes into the various different personality types, he was one of the people who developed loads of this. And I came across him in a very small book with just some quotes, but I found these quotes so profound that I started just buying his books when I was in my, mid-teens, basically 16, 17, when I was sent to this annoying little village where I spent lots of nights just like reading and going for walks. And I felt, because there wasn't much else going on, I felt this really deep connection around the stuff that he was writing about and the stuff that, you know, I was going through as a young person, having to, you know, survive and thrive in a world that wasn't entirely mine, in an environment that I wasn't able to control in any way, shape or form. So I wanted to really understand, like, what tools can I have at my disposal? And one of the biggest tools that Carl Gustav Jung really described was your dreams. So since age 16, 17, I've got like dream journals that I use every morning. I've got a pen and a book next to my bed, and I write my, you know, when I have a dream, I write it down, and then in the evening, look at it and analyze it. So to me, it really helped me see another side of myself that is coming through and revealing itself through dreams that I get to have access to if I choose to engage with them and understand them and try and figure out what they could be telling me. So that was kind of something that I felt quite quite connected to. And, you know, Carl Gustav Jung, you know, he released so many more books. Like, I've got a whole library of his books here at home, and, you know, so many videos. But yeah, obviously He died many years ago. I think he died in the 60s, from what I know. So he's long gone. But to me, his insights, they really stood the test of time, and they're still so relevant.
And what specifically for entrepreneurs, or as an entrepreneur yourself who is responsible for lots of other entrepreneurs, what are the lessons that you got from Carl Jung as he mentored you, that you now still feel are the most useful for you?
I guess as an entrepreneur, like, you have to really get to know yourself. You have to know the things that you're good at and the things that you're not so good at. And, you know, what makes you tick, what makes you work, what makes you excited, engaged, motivated, and what makes you scared and fearful and doubtful. And looking at them through a journal or a diary can already be really powerful. So if you're not into journaling or diarizing things, I strongly encourage people to, you know, start a journal, write down your stuff, you know, what makes you scared, what makes you excited, what happened during the day, how did you react, and so on. And then looking, like, you know, when things go wrong, like, how do you react? How do you respond to things? And looking at your responses and looking at them through multiple lenses that you have available, such as your personal past experiences, or sharing those experiences, or sharing what you're going through with a mentor or a coach and asking them for help and support. And I found the two things quite powerful, looking at my own shit through my own lens, but then also sharing some of that and being open and being vulnerable and being transparent with a mentor who I trust to, you know, to help and support. And then finding other insights and other learnings from other people how they've dealt with this. So yeah, looking at my own things, trying to analyze how I can be a bit better or fail less, and then sharing some of these things and getting them from a mentor, a coach, and figuring out how they would have addressed them. And often in between them, solutions on how to solve problems and challenges will come forth. And sometimes they're hard. You know, sometimes there's no easy way of looking at something and going, shit, I really messed up. I need to rectify this. You know, sometimes if it you know, involves a member of the team, apologize to them if you've messed up something, because, you know, it's hectic times being a founder. And, you know, stuff breaks all the time, but being nice about them and being human about them makes being an entrepreneur less daunting and stressful.
Yeah, I think it is right. When you're in the sort of cut and thrust of things, early doors, it takes a certain act of will to make this thing happen. The thing being the business, the startup. But that can come at a cost for yourself and to the people around you. Particularly if you're not conscious or aware of perhaps how you're coming across or your strengths or weaknesses. And the line I like from Carl Jung is that he says, unless you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. Like, things will just happen to you. It's just fate. That's always going to happen. But what it is a reaction. The world's reacting to you because you're putting out actions, words, an energy into the world that is perhaps not really working for you on your behalf in the long term. And I have found from my direct experience, by the way, that the whole point of this podcast is because I blew the business up and I did turn it around. But a lot of the unconscious behaviors I had create a form of sort of perfect storm.
Yeah.
And the perfect storm, I didn't want it, didn't plan it. By many, many metrics of being a good entrepreneur, I was winning. But there was a lot of stuff that wasn't right. And I had to go through a very painful experience for me to wake up. And so for me, what I kind of really resonated from your the mentorship of Carl Jung to you was the mentorship he's given me was the sort of prompt to be aware of the unconscious, to be aware of drives that are perhaps deep and perhaps dark. And this idea of the shadow is something I very much resonate with. The dark side to the powerful creative side I have is a powerful, perhaps self-destructive side. And those two things are very interrelated, like the yin and yang. And I can't kind of wish one away. I've got to integrate those things together. So for me, the concept of the shadow was one that really helped me be a better entrepreneur.
I mean, now that you are saying it, I think for many, many years, you know, when I looked at my life again, and, you know, running, I literally ran away from home, and I also ran away from my dad and from my from the opportunity to run the thing that he has built. So for many, many years, I think, and this came to me much later, I was really trying to prove him wrong, that because he always said, you would have had such a good business. You would have made good money. You would have had little to do. It would have been such a good thing for you to do. But I ran away and I turned him down and I turned the offer down. So for many years, I think probably for the first 10, 15 years, after being in the UK, I still wanted to prove him wrong that I could build my own thing and that it was going to be something valuable and that I enjoyed building it and doing it. But it took me a long time to really kind of make peace with him and for him to make peace with me that we did separate and it was for the best for both of us. But you know, talk about subconscious forces pulling you. So for me, it was, the fear of failure. What if I would fail with one of these businesses? And what if he was right? And why didn't I go back and build his, so all these things were swirling around in my mind. But again, it's this emancipation of our youth and of the people that we were, and the ego and the self that we once were. You have to, like every young person, every young adult has to emancipate themselves from, both parents and, society, and forge their own path if they really want to be happy. So again, having some concepts and constructs around it, like the ones that Carl Jung provided, was really helpful as a founder.
I agree with all that. And it's the kind of hero's journey kind of thing of going out into the unknown and proving yourself and fighting the dragon and trying to kind of come back with something. And the motivation to do that can be simultaneously both good and bad. There's a toxicity to that, if not made aware of.
Mm.
That can quite easily drive some reactive behaviors that might not work for you in the long term. And yeah. Your relationships and your emotional health. And I think what's really, I think what's great about what you've been saying and really what I hope people listening can take away from that is the more work you do on yourself and however you get to that, whether it's through Carl Jung or other forms of teacher or mentor, there are, you are both the opportunity and the problem simultaneously. And it's very, very difficult to know when your attribute that's really going really well for you right now is going to start to undermine you. It's very difficult to gauge that in advance and you have to be very mindful. And so journaling for me is a very important practice in my day. I mean, I do it every morning. I do a practice called Morning Pages, which I got from a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. 3 pages longhand in my journal and just it all comes out. And it's so interesting after a page and a half, what surfaces and all the weird kinks and quirks I have that's making me worried and anxious and fearful and whatever. Oh yeah, maybe it's no. And I'm 50 this year, and I'm still at the start, I believe, of that exploratory journey. So I've got a long, exciting inward journey to go through. This has been an absolutely brilliant conversation. I want to ask you a question. But the one thing I really want to ask you, I'm not going to ask you that question. You set yourself a 10-year plan, and now you've hit 10 years, and I believe you're off on a sabbatical.
Yeah. So, and again, because it's called Dirk's Cookbook, which is like my much bigger, broader kind of journaling activity where I look at things through phases, like maybe what does the next year look like or what do the next 5 years, what could they look like, etc. And I think in 2018, when I did a journey through Japan but on a train, I kind of looked at what the last 5 years and the 5 years before that looked like. And then the 5 years before that. And I thought, I saw some themes emerging that a lot of big changes seem to be happening every five years. So I then looked ahead and I looked at, where would I want to be in the next 5 years, knowing it's going to be 2023. Mm. And I wanted, the organization to be of a certain size. I wanted the organization to have a certain number of team members. I wanted to deliver a certain impact. And we've surpassed all of that 2 years ago. So to me, the plan that I made in 2018 came to fruition much, much more quickly because I felt like there was a plan that I could work against. And I asked the right people for help and support on making that plan become a reality. And now where we are now in 2023, we've surpassed the plan by about 2 years. So we're now looking at like, what does 2030 look like? Where would we want to deliver things in 2030? And yeah, I am going to take a short breather for 3 months now, because there's too much going on. And for me to do a 6 month break is too much. And I felt too uncomfortable with taking a 6 month break, but a 3 month break seemed much more feasible. And yeah, back to Japan for 3 months, my favorite place. And I will use that time to also get perspective. And with distance comes perspective, and not being in the day-to-day motions of running the organization, but having amazing and capable people to do that when I'm taking a short break. That in itself builds leadership in the organization and de-risks, me, not coming back, being on a holiday. Some people say like, oh, what if you ever get run over by a bus? So we're now saying, what if we go on a holiday that is just a very long holiday? But like building the kind of leadership in your organization that can be there whether you're there or not, that's always been something that my dad, for example, never really achieved. He always had to be there. And for me, I wanted to build an organization where I didn't have to be there, but where there are amazing people who know what they're doing and how they're going to be doing it, whether I'm there or not. And that's something that we've achieved, I think, in the last 5 years, where we have a really amazing team who are delivering really impactful programs and activities, and where I'm still adding value, but I don't have to be there and hustle hard on every front. There's now people who are much better than me on various things in the organization.
Well, that's great. And that's the first guest on this podcast, a guy called Dan Sullivan, is the world's number one entrepreneurial coach. Check it out, the episode. He's in fact coming on in another couple of weeks. But he has a concept of creating a self-managing company. So it works without you. So you can focus on what you love to do rather than what you feel you have to do. And I think that's the game, because if you said at the start you wanted to bring in-source fun into work, and yep, that is the game. If you can earn a crust, you need to all pay the bills and do a great purposeful job for people and have a great sense of purpose and have some fun, what's not to like?
That's right.
Well, where can we find out more about you, Dirk?
I think LinkedIn is probably my favorite go-to place, but also, check out our website, hajenterprise.org. And we are hoping to support... we've supported about 8,000 founders in the last 10 years. We're hoping to get to about 20,000 founders by 2030. And yeah, if you are looking for help and support to start or grow or scale your business, we can be here for you.
I would highly recommend everybody check him out and connect on LinkedIn and see all this amazing work you're doing, because it's really impressive. The impact report is actually really interesting to read. And it's so interesting to hear that the little method behind all of that. And I think that's something we can all build on and learn from. So thank you so much for being so open. What a fantastic, insightful conversation. Thank you, Dirk. I'll see you soon. I'll see everybody next time.
Thanks, Dan.
Are you an impact startup founder? Are you looking to do good in the world? And do you want a team to build your tech product? But importantly, do you want that tech product to actually do what you want it to do based on the vision you've got? Then maybe, just maybe, my company, The Tech Department, could be a good fit. And as a founder of a startup, particularly in the early stages, every penny you invest is critical. It's adding value. It's creating improvement to your business. So our difference is we focus first on improvement. And that mindset shift is unique. And we turn that mindset shift into a method, which we called The Tech Bootcamp. And it works really great. We get great feedback from all of our startup clients. And when you've got your business profitable and you want to build your in-house team, then we can help you with that too and hand over in a way that's not weird and we're not hanging onto the code or anything stupid like that. So if you like that idea, check us out at www.thetechdept.com. T-H-E-T-E-C-H-D-E-P-T. The Tech Department, thetechdept.com. The worst name to pronounce as a domain name on a podcast. Check it out.